we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core. Here on American Family Radio, I'm Walker Wildman. Glad to be with you here on the program. This is our Friday edition of the show. We're going to have Dr. Jessica Peck with us in the second segment. We try to have her on once a month or so to talk about parenting and how to handle your teenage son or daughter and some of the lingering threats that are out there for our young people. So we'll talk with Dr. Peck about that in the second segment. And then Chris will be with us in the last, as he is usually. So before we jump into some of the headlines for today, we got some pretty interesting stuff to talk about. I want to remind you that in 2025, we already have our tours that we do, whether it be Washington, D.C., Williamsburg, which includes Jamestown and Yorktown. And now Boston is a brand new tour that we've added to the lineup in 2025. We're going to be doing all of those in June, September, and October of 2025 with the Wildman Group. So if you want to check out that, you can always visit wildmangroup.com, wildmangroup.com to check out those tour dates. All these tours are from a Christian perspective, so you're going to get America's providential history on these tours with well-known historian Stephen McDowell. And then, Lord willing, in 2026, we'll be back in the Holy Land in Israel. So looking forward to that as well, but that's a little further out, and we don't have registration, obviously, open for that. But if you want to go to Williamsburg, you want to go to Washington, D.C., you want to go to Boston, all of those three tours are up, and registration is open now at wildmangroup.com. Psalm 129 is where we are this week. Verse 5, may all who hate Zion be put to shame and turned backward. So, memo to not just the Islamic terrorists that hate Jews and hate Israel, but I would argue memo to any American politician that doesn't firmly support Israel and their right to exist, and their right to protect their homeland. Verse 5, may all who hate Zion be put to shame and turned backwards. And you say, well, you know, I'm a Democrat, and I don't hate Israel. I just think that fill in the blank. Well, what we're seeing now is that the what's being couched as a, quote, balanced approach is really a backhanded way of hating Israel. Because when you get to the root of this pro-Islam, this Muslim-sympathetic approach that the Democrat Party has, the root of it is really a hatred for the people of Israel. It's really a hatred for the Jewish people. It may not be couched that way, but when you get to the root of it, it's rooted in Muslim hatred for the Jewish people, and the Democrat Party has this weird kind of affinity in that direction, and that's being exposed with the Biden administration and Kamala Harris and their handling of this entire conflict in the Middle East. Jumping on onto election-related topics, speaking of Biden and Harris, this there's some interesting developments, and I've been asked a couple times in recent days, hey, what do you think about the election? How do you think it's going to turn out? And I was talking to a gentleman in my office yesterday who was by visiting, and he said, you know, people I talk to, they want to know what you guys think about this. You know, how's this going to go? And I have an assessment, and I may be wrong. Wouldn't be the first time. Won't be the last. But I have some pretty substantial prospects or theories about how this election's going to go, just based on where we are today. So Biden was, just to set this up, we got, you know, a little bit left in this segment. Joe Biden was trailing Donald Trump back 2 or 3 months ago by nearly double digit. When you look at the polling, Biden was down anywhere from 5 to 10 points in battleground states compared to President Trump. The chasm between Biden and Trump was unlike anything I've ever seen. That's why Biden's no longer in the race. Biden himself admitted this. They may want to blame it on his age. They may want to blame it on his mental acuity. Biden himself said the reason, at least this is what he said, the reason I'm no longer in the race is because I was polling very badly. Now, that's not a quote. That's not a word for word. But I played the clip a few weeks ago, and Biden basically said, I was polling badly, and I was going to hurt the whole Democrat ticket, so I backed out. That's what Joe Biden said, which is partially true. I think he still has, there were some age questions, there were some mental acuity questions, but at the crux of it, the Democrats didn't like how badly Biden was polling. All right. So Kamala Harris is clearly polling better than Joe Biden because she's living, breathing, and she can actually talk. So the Democrats are doing better than they were 2, 3, 4 months ago, but Kamala Harris is not shining. She's not doing great to look at the poll numbers. So two specific numbers I want to point out just to focus us in on this segment. At this time in the election in 2020, let's just look at Pennsylvania because everybody I talk to says this is coming down to Pennsylvania. And I can't disagree with that. At this point in the 2020 election in Pennsylvania, Biden was up 4 percentage points, nearly 5, in the Real Clear Politics average of polls. At this point in 2020, Biden was up about 4 to 5 percentage points against Trump. Well, Biden only won that state by, I would argue, probably less than 1%. I don't know the exact number, but less than 1%. It was very close, put it that way. Well, Kamala Harris's average is up under 1% right now in 2024. Under 1%. 0.8 to be specific. And in at least 50% of these polls, they're tied. They're statistically tied. In a couple of them, Trump's up 1 or 2 points. That's a big deal. Just to go back to 2016, Hillary Clinton was polling at this time in the race about 2, 2.5 points above Trump. Well, Trump ended up winning that state. So the margin of error, what I'm getting at is the margin of error here is somewhere between 3 and 5%, which is probably normal, right? 3% margin of error, 5% is a little bit embarrassing for the polling firm, but 3% is pretty normal. But my point is if you notice the trend here, the swing in favor or the underestimating always is happening with Trump, meaning they're always underestimating Trump's favorability and Trump's margin in the state of Pennsylvania. So if Kamala Harris, for example, is up 1 point going into election day, Trump wins by 2 percentage points. If things take the same trend line that they did in 2016 and 2020. Will they? I don't know. But this is very interesting to follow. Kamala Harris is not in a good place in Pennsylvania compared to where Biden and Clinton were. That's a fact. And as I was telling Bobby, leading into Election Day, Donald Trump's job is to not shoot himself in the foot. All right. And completely no pun, no jokes intended there in light of the assassination attempts. The other thing is that the mail-in ballots, this is an important thing note to watch. The mail-in ballots have played a big part in Democrats winning Pennsylvania, especially in 2020. And when you look at the Democrat mail-in ballot request to date, listen to this. Kamala Harris is down about 300,000 ballots. Yes, you heard me right. Not 3,000, not 30,000. Kamala Harris is down about 300,000 mail-in ballots compared to where Biden was in 2020. And remember, we're talking razor thin margins here. All right. But 300,000, that's correct. So to phrase that another way, Biden had 300,000 more mail-in ballot requests, and I'm saying Joe Biden, it's the Democrats, so it could cover governor, etc. But the Democrats in 2020 had 300,000 more mail-in ballot requests compared to the Democrats in 2024 right now. That's a big, big deal. Based on those numbers, you could probably, if you're smart, and I'm not smart enough, someone could probably run some analytics on the mail-in ballot, success rate, how many of those ballots actually get mailed back in, right? What percentage of Democrats that request a ballot actually mail it back in, and how many of them vote for the Democrat nominee for president? You could probably run those numbers and lock Pennsylvania in for Trump even before Election Day. That's just something interesting to look at. But those two things, the Real Clear Politics average and being well within the margin of error and always leaning towards the Republican nominee when it comes to who's being underestimated, and then the fact that Democrats are down 300,000 mail-in ballots compared to this time in 2020, folks, that is not looking good for Kamala Harris. Once again, I may be completely wrong. We may be sitting here just like we were in 2020 going, wow, we didn't see that coming. But folks, we've been encouraging people to vote. All right. And we still have 30 plus days before the election. A lot can happen between now and then. But I'm just telling you where we stand today. All right. I may circle back in 3 weeks from now and have a completely different opinion about this, but people asked what I thought, and here's what I think. I think that at least looking at Pennsylvania, Democrats are in a pretty bad position. They're in pretty bad shape. One other interesting fact that we can't forget, folks, that are more anecdotal, but still pile on to the really negative perception of Kamala Harris is this. She was polling 1% in the 2020 Democrat primary when she ran against Joe Biden and the rest of the crew. Folks, that's bad. That's really, really bad. 1%, she dropped out before South Carolina, didn't even make it to California or her home state. How do you win the presidency when you can't get over 1% of your own party? These are Democrats. Also, let's don't forget that Kamala Harris was installed as the Democrat nominee without a single Democrat primary voter casting a single ballot for Kamala Harris to be the presidential nominee for their party. So it nearly seems, if we're looking at this rationally, it really seems that it's nearly impossible for Kamala Harris to win. It really does. It really looks, when you add all of these things together and you take out the propaganda, but these are hard, cold facts. When you add all of this stuff together in one picture, I don't see how she wins. I just don't. It doesn't matter if you do some shenanigans in Philadelphia, you pick up a truck full of, illegitimate ballots, on election night and dump them at the back door. I'm not sure the Democrats can overcome this. I mean, it's going to take some serious lifting for the Democrats to overcome what's going on with Kamala Harris and the presidential race. And I'll end this whole theory segment and what I think about this election to state that if Kamala Harris underperforms on Election Day, that is not going to be good for any Democrat U.S. Senator running for election and any Democrat congressman running for election on that same ballot on November 5th.
At
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you on this edition of the program. Well, if you missed last segment, I pretty much told you what I thought about the 2024 election, who's going to win, who's going to lose, and I specifically nailed down some numbers in the state of Pennsylvania. And I've read multiple analysts say that it's going to come down to Pennsylvania, which I think is true. And what happens in Pennsylvania will indicate what's going to happen in other states as well, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, et cetera. But nonetheless, some interesting things to think about as we head into Election Day. Changing subjects, Dr. Jessica Peck is back with us. She's host of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show here on American Family Radio each weekday, 2 to 3 Central, right after this show, actually. Dr. Peck, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Walker. It's always a joy to join you.
Well, I hear good things about the show. I occasionally am able to listen in, but we appreciate your content and your wisdom that you bring to the program. And I also just finished reading your column that you wrote for our magazine as well. So a lot of good coming out of the Dr. Nurse Mama program, and appreciate your work. Hey, Dr. Peck, I want to mention or bring up really a report that you made brought to our attention from the Department of Health and Human Services. And this specifically came from the U.S. Surgeon General. And it has to do with not the mental health and well-being of teenagers or children, which is often what we talk about on the program and specifically on your show, but this has to do with the mental health and the well-being of parents, which is an interesting angle but ought to be talked about. Give us a little backgrounder here.
Sure, absolutely. Well, when this report came out, honestly, it was nothing that was surprising to me. I've seen this in my research where we're seeing parents having such increased anxiety. And what the report basically found were that there were 33% of parents who were reporting high levels of stress in the past month compared to 20% of other adults who were not actively parenting. And we see parents who are living in a really tough economy, Walker. They are worried about putting food on the table. We see a lot of parents who are deeply concerned about the election. They are glued to their television. They feel angry. They feel anxious. They feel fearful. And we also see a generation of parents who are competing with cultural forces that are nothing like we've ever seen, where parents are really replaceable by online social media forums, but kids can find other people who will tell them their parents are out of date, out of touch, that they don't know what they're talking about, and they'll find this online echo chamber. And what we know is kids just want to be seen and heard and known and loved. And for the first time, we've got competition for that, and all of those factors together are making parents very anxious. And I'm hearing from our listeners every day saying, yeah, that's me.
Yeah, this context gets overlooked often. And what I mean by that is we're either, I'm guilty of this, we're either talking about, and I had Dr. George Barna on earlier in the week, we're either talking about studies about how teens are doing, or we're talking about studies of how adults broadly are doing, which many of those adults may not be parents necessarily. But this study of focusing specifically on parents is kind of a unique angle that at least I haven't talked about often. But Dr. Peck, if parents aren't doing well, which is what this report says, up to 33% of parents report high levels of stress in the past month, compared to 20% of other adults. So, but if my point is if parents aren't doing well, Dr. Peck, how do we think kids are going to be doing?
Kids are going to be doing a lot worse because they do what we do, not what we say. I mean, we know the best way to get kids to eat their vegetables is for us to eat our vegetables, for them to wear their seatbelt is for us to wear our seatbelt. And we are modeling high levels of anxiety, and we don't have effective coping skills, and we're giving them messages that the world is just hopeless and we're just angry and afraid, they're going to model those things. And what scares me, Walker, is that a lot of kids, I think, will look for messages of hope from other places. So I think it's important for us to remember that no matter what is happening in the world, that God is in control. He is not surprised by any of this election craziness, by any of the cultural chaos. He is not pacing the floor of heaven, wringing his hands, saying, oh my goodness, what's going to happen next? He knows, he sees, he cares. And we have got to be constant in modeling that for our kids. And if we are modeling that and being authentic, they are going to pick up on that. We also need to be really intentional in turning our cares into prayers. We express so much worry. We talk over the heads of our children a lot. And we think, oh, they're not really listening. They're not paying attention. But they are listening. They are paying attention because I know they go to school and they talk to other kids about it, or they go to their church group and they talk about what their parents are talking about. They share those worldviews. And so when we have cares that are heavy like that, we really need to be intentional about praying about it. The third thing that I recommend for parents is to turn off the news, unless you're listening to AFR, of course, right?
Exactly.
And encouraging, but really, if you are listening to a steady stream of doom and gloom, you really need to hang up and hang out, as my oldest daughter says, and really engage with your family. They want you to be socially, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually present. And that can't be if we're just consumed with worry and fear and anxiety all the time.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And you and I have talked about social media extensively on this program during your visits. And of course, you talk about it in your book and on your program as well. But I've just noticed it's fair to say much of what is consumed on social media and online that you might be telling yourself, I'm going to kind of get up to speed on the news. Much of it's not news. It's just not news.
Right.
It's what other people's lives are like and what you wish your life would be like, et cetera, and gossip, et cetera. So it's not necessarily news. Also, you know, the television always having to be on, that can be a mm-hmm. problem as well. But two things that I thought of, Dr. Peck, is, and I kind of wanted to get your feedback on this. I've noticed in my own life as a parent to four young boys and Lord willing in October, a young girl, is that the discussions that parents have, that adults have, and parents have with one another are oftentimes inappropriate around the children. For example, having a financial discussion with your spouse about how you're going to pay the bills, that's not an appropriate conversation around your five-year-old, your seven-year-old. Because you're sharing that anxiety with them, and it's not appropriate for them to have to take that anxiety at that age, especially on such, you know, important matters like finances or things like that. And so I would just encourage parents to be careful about which discussions they have around their children, because some discussions are better off left between the privacy of your bedroom or the kitchen table after the kids are asleep. And then the second thing that I wrote down, Dr. Peck, is that parents really need to bring a calm demeanor to situations that their children are going through. One thing I try to do, for better or worse, is anytime there's an incident that occurs with my children, they fall off their bike, you know, they stump their foot, etc., my first instinct is to say that everything's going to be okay. Now, do I know that everything's going to be okay? Maybe not all the time, but it probably is going to be okay at the end of the day. So just kind of exerting this demeanor of calmness and like, let's everybody take a deep breath here, goes a long way, as opposed to inserting anxiety and fretting and worry that children are already dealing with.
I couldn't agree more with you. And it reminds me of a time when my children were younger and we had a minivan. I was a minivan mom. My husband and I were driving and the kids were actually, you know, kind of quiet in the back seat. We were talking, it was during a presidential election. We were talking about a political issue and we were fired up. We were completely on the same page. You know, we were passionate, sharing our convictions. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm so glad I'm married to a godly man who feels this way about this issue. And it felt so good for me to talk about it. But then in the back seat, it got way too quiet. And you know, Walker, you have a lot of kids when there is a group quiet, that is never a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I turned around and look, and I see all my kids crying in the back seat, and they're scared. And they say, "Why are you and Daddy fighting?" Now, we weren't fighting at all, but that was their perception. And Walker, I think that's what is driving some of the anxiety that kids feel, because they see us consuming news and they see two main emotions from us. They see us afraid and they see us angry. Mm. And then they think, I don't want anything to do with that. And what does this mean the world is? So just what you were talking about, being developmentally appropriate, but also being calm and reassuring, acknowledging their worries and fears, saying, yes, I'm worried about this, but I know God is in control. And so many times we just lose our focus, especially in the election season that just seems to get crazier by the minute. But we really have to be cognizant of what God has given us to steward to our families. And that is their emotional security. It's a big responsibility and it's hard.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Peck, thanks so much for joining us this segment. And just remind our audience of the name of your book and then, of course, when they can listen to your program.
Absolutely. So my book is Behind Closed Doors, a guide to help parents and teens navigate through life's toughest issues. You can find me on the Dr. Nurse Mama Show using my professor brain, hands-on nursing experience, and heart as a mom to be a guide on the side to prescribe hope for healthy families. Every day, 2 p.m. Central, live. Love our listeners, Walker. They are just the most gracious, wonderful group of people. And it's been so great to walk through all of this with them, to learn and to be together, to find hope in a world that is in desperate need of it. So thanks so much for having me on. And we'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Peck. Glad to have you on.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
All right. That's Dr. Jessica Peck. And she hosts the Dr. Nurse Mama program here on American Family Radio each weekday. And folks, these discussions of marriage and family are critical. And there's two programs that we've really brought on in the last year to hopefully fill this void. And when I say fill this void, there's not a lot out there when it comes to talk shows and commentaries, etc., that bridge the gap between the cultural issues that we face in America and marriage and family. You can find one extreme or the other. You can find some conservative talk radio, and all they want to talk about is politics and, you know, things like that, or hot-button cultural issues, which is fine. We do that here on the program. Or there's the extreme opposite, and they just want to talk about, you know, how to take your wife on a date, or, you know, how to teach your children the Ten Commandments, which are noble and good things. But what is the void in America when it comes to entertainment and news and commentary is bridging that gap, that divide between those two extreme opposites that I just described. And Dr. Jessica Peck's program does just that. I mean, Dr. Peck is not mincing words. She is not glazing over, looking over the important issues. She's talking about everything that our teenagers and our children are dealing with. She's talking about pornography. She's talking about sexting. She's talking about vaping. She's talking about anxiety, depression, obesity. She is talking about all of these issues that are heavy issues that families and parents and children and teenagers are dealing with. And then another program that we recently brought on is Them Before Us with Katie Faust. And we've interviewed Katie Faust. We're going to have her on in the future. But she heads up Them Before Us. And the sole focus that Katie's organization has is focusing on the rights of children, not the rights of adults, not the rights of parents. What are the rights of children? And I don't know why I haven't thought of this angle before, but when I started reading up about Katie and her work and listening to her interviews, she is making strong cases that children have rights too, that children have rights to a mom and a dad, and not just a mom and a dad, but they have a right to their biological mom and dad. That should be our starting negotiating position on a public policy standpoint. And of course, there's exceptions that need to be made when it comes to adoption or foster care. But God's plan A, if you will, was that children would have their biological parents. And so we got to keep harping on that, keep pointing that out, because folks, there is a movement of really dark and wicked things in our nation that children are being subjected to, and it all falls under the guise of marriage and family. And what I mean by that is, when we legitimized as a nation, when the Supreme Court legitimized same-sex relationships as being quote-unquote marriages, even though we know they're not marriages by God's design, but when the government started saying, yeah, this is a marriage, talking about two dudes or two women, well, then they started adopting folks. They immediately started applying for adoptions and applying for foster care immediately after Obergefell. And so now we have who knows how many children that were either adopted or fostered into these same-sex households where these children are being deprived of either a mommy or a daddy. All right? Because men can't do women things and women can't do men things. It's as simple as that. So our nation, by allowing children to be adopted and fostered into these same-sex households, we are depriving children of either a mommy or a daddy. And then there's this other issue related of surrogacy, where we're allowing people, women, to carry other people's babies and then hand them off in surrogacy as some kind of financial transaction for that child to never know or meet their biological mother ever, ever again. These are major issues.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here with you on this last segment. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast At the Core wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also catch the video on Facebook or on the At the Core At the Core Facebook page, but also AFA Stream. That's what I was trying to get out. And Chris Woodward is in with us this last segment, as he is each week. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you. We made it another week, America.
Yes, we are 1 week closer to the election, mm-hmm. and a lot of interesting developments that we'll talk about. One of those is the Congress just passed legislation, a bill that would provide equal Secret Service protection to both to all presidential candidates for both party nominations. I'm not sure that that extends to the primary, probably not. But once the two parties have their picks, then the protection would extend further to those candidates. So this is in response to the assassination attempts, two at least that we know of in recent months on President Trump's life. I do want to play a clip just to give us a little bit of background. So the left has still not toned down their rhetoric. Shock, shock, I know. But let's listen to clip one. This is actually Biden's Commerce Secretary saying that we need to extinguish Trump for good.
What he says is the opposite. It's just another lie. Like, how did we get here? Let's extinguish him for good. We have an answer. We have a remarkably talented candidate who is sincere, who's pragmatic, who's open. Let's just get it done.
Let's extinguish him for good. Mm-hmm. Quote, let's get it done.
Yeah, there are a couple of things here. First of all, a cabinet member should not be at a campaign
what
event.
What he says
should
is
not
the
be
opposite.
Stumping for somebody.
That's a good point.
They're
not supposed to do that.
Right, and that's the thing. That's what's bothered me for the past couple of weeks with the press briefings. They're pretty much campaign events for Kamala. Now,
you KJP, make a good point.
Yeah, KJP will say things like, well, you know, I can't do this. You'll have to ask the campaign. But she will more often than not these days, now that Biden has passed the torch to Kamala, she will find a way to talk up Kamala and talk down Donald Trump or quote-unquote MAGA Republicans.
Well, she said, she was quoted saying that there's no daylight between Biden and Harris and their policies. Mm-hmm. Like, they're the same. And I thought that the Hatch Act, remember they tried to make a scandal about President Trump and the Hatch Act?
Yes.
Didn't that, isn't that what she's violating?
Well,
when they're campaigning from the press briefing room?
And these are the same people that didn't like, you know, Trump having a phone call with foreign people like Zelensky, but then he comes over here and stumps for Biden while Democrats autograph bombs.
Yeah.
It's a violation of the Hatch Act when I see it.
Yes.
Basically what it is.
Exactly. That's exactly right. One more clip is this. This is a Democrat congressman that I had never heard of until today. But he was on and he blamed, let's see, he blamed the political violence and the climate that we're in of political violence. He said it's quote entirely due to Donald Trump. This representative from Massachusetts. Let's listen.
I am concerned because, as Romney said, when he says something, believe it. And he has called for military tribunals to execute his rivals.
Talking about
he has
Trump.
Said that if he loses, it's the Jews' fault. And scapegoating Jews is a time-honored tactic of totalitarians. And we know that mentally ill people will follow through on those threats. So the political, the prospects for political violence in this country, unfortunately, are heightened. And it's entirely due to Donald Trump and his enablers like J.D. Vance, which is why this election is so critical.
So there you have it, Chris. Mm-hmm. So the two crazies,
yes.
Which I don't like using the term mentally ill for everybody who does evil things, because there's this thing called sin, and your mind may work perfectly well, but you're just committed to doing evil things. That doesn't mean you're mentally ill. But these two attempted assassinations on President Trump's life, those came from left-wing Democrats that quote-unquote went crazy. And there's zero cases of this as far as assassination attempts on the Republican side, but he says it's, quote, entirely due to Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump, like, just lives in their head, and they want you to believe that if anything is bad, like, if you wake up tomorrow and you step on a Lego, it's Donald Trump's fault.
Do they know it?
So,
you okay, Chris?
Because he lowered the tariffs on Lego imports.
Yes, somehow it's Donald Trump's fault. So, you know, if you eat tuna when you wanted a T-bone, it's Donald Trump's fault.
Yeah, because the fishing boats in the Pacific couldn't get a permit from the Trump administration.
I mean, he lives in their head like rent-free. That's why people on the right will say things like Trump derangement syndrome, because literally these people love to hate the man.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could have sat here until next Friday playing clips of people on television shows blaming Trump for his rhetoric as to why the guy in the bushes on the golf course wanted to take his life. That's been the case, too. So this is like one of many examples that we could have played if you've not been paying attention to it's Trump's fault that people want to kill him.
Yeah, Kamala Harris, I talked about this in the first segment. She's such a bad candidate. And I'm not just saying that because I'm ideologically conservative, but just looking at her, let's just look at the last 6 years. She polled 1% of the Democrat primary in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't duly elected to be the Democrat presidential nominee this cycle. The delegates elected her, but not the people. And she has a hard time doing interviews and giving specific answers. I mean, her favorite word right now is the dreams and aspirations.
Yes.
I mean, that somebody said, Kamala Harris, you need to say this, and you need to say as many times as you can. And ever since that debate, she's been saying, and the dreams and aspirations, and the dreams and aspirations.
I'm a middle-class kid.
I worked at McDonald's growing up, although McDonald's corporate says they have no record of her working with them. But nonetheless, she says she worked there. But you have some clips and some funny stuff on this.
Yes. So Kamala went and did a rare sit-down interview with someone this week. In this case, it was MSNBC, which some people like to call MSDNC. But she did do a sit-down interview, which is something she does not normally do. See if you guys can spot how many times she uses the word holistically in this very brief clip.
Some of the work is going to be through what we do in terms of giving benefits and assistance to state and local governments around transit dollars and looking holistically at the connection between that and housing and looking holistically at the incentives we in the federal government can create for local and state governments to actually engage in planning in a holistic manner that includes prioritizing affordable housing for working people.
She used the word holistically 3 times in 23 seconds.
She's trying to make her sound spiritual.
Yes.
She must have went to like a naturalist nutrition shop that morning.
GNC.
Yeah. You know, the vitamin drops were kicking in.
I don't know, Chris. If she was talking about the FDA or Americans' diets, then holistically three times, we might give her a pass. But when you say the word transit and holistic in the same sentence, you have completely lost your audience.
Well, and one other thing, too, like everybody has mannerisms. You know, Trump likes to, like, he kind of turns his hands. Yeah, so everybody speaks in ways. Everybody has mannerisms. But what we can't show to you, America, is the fact that during this very brief clip, there was a pause where in the middle of her answer, she stopped and nodded at the interviewer like she was supposed to understand and know what she was talking about. But the sad thing is, and this is all the more reason why people need to really pay attention to where they get their information, the same person who sat through this interview went on to justify the fact that she rambles and does not give clear, concise answers. This is MSNBC Stephanie Ruhle here defending the interview.
Work, and one could watch that and say, well, she didn't give a clear, direct answer. That's okay, because we are not talking about clear or direct issues.
They were talking about the economy. But we weren't talking about clear, direct issues. Therefore, it's okay that it's a word salad of a
Well, then what are you doing? If you're not talking about clear and direct issues with T-minus 40 days or whatever the number is to the election, then what on earth are we doing?
Yeah, it's stumping for Kamala Harris.
Yeah,
trying to explain away her lack of ability to answer a question such as, and in this particular case, there were some decent questions in this interview. You can find it online and watch it in its entirety. But like she asked her, hey, you have said things like there's price gouging in the grocery stores and retail stores.
Yeah.
But people are saying price controls are going to make it worse. How do you answer those kinds of things? And she went on to say again for the umpteenth time, so I was a middle class kid.
I don't have to answer your question because I was a middle class kid. Chris, I have an assessment here. I think after listening to this, and I'm learning a lot of new things today, but after listening to this, I think Kamala Harris is worse than Biden. From this vantage point, there's a lot of ways we could go here. But I think that Kamala Harris is worse than Biden from a pure intellectual knowledge vantage point. What Biden had on his side, despite his politics, his terrible ideology, and his pro-abortion, all of his radical viewpoints, which Biden was a radical, he was no moderate, is no moderate. Biden actually had extensive experience in government. All right. Now, too much, in my opinion. 50 years is too much. But he knew the ins and outs of this is how the Senate works, this is how foreign policy works, and here's who I need to negotiate with, and, you know, here's how the military works, and here's how I talk to the generals, and, you know, here's how a briefing goes, right? He knew all the ins and outs, the inner workings of the government. So he could advance his bad policy positions in government. Now, this term might be different than his vice presidential term because this term, I'm not sure he knows where he is. But Kamala Harris, on the other hand, she knows where she is, but she doesn't know anything else. She doesn't know how the government works. She doesn't know how to talk specifics about tariffs, price controls, legislation surrounding the economy, how to negotiate with the Fed, how to control goods and services, you know, how to bring manufacturing back to America. She doesn't know any of that. Like, if she does, she's not talking about it, right? This level of shallowness, I'm not sure it's ever seen the Oval Office before.
Yeah.
Except when she's gone in there as VP.
I mean, there has been a part of me that thinks, okay, maybe she could handle the job and she's just really terrible at communicating. But people, and not just Americans, look to the president of the United States for comfort, for a sense of peace and all these other things. And she can't do that
right
in any given stage. You know, when she came out quickly after being given the torch by Biden, she threw out, we're going to have price controls. And then her campaign, when they realized in the in like a 48-hour period after that, they walked it back saying, yeah, no, it's not what we meant. She can't be doing this with foreign countries, allies, yeah, adversaries.
Look, if you're the CEO of the country, and I'm not saying Trump was the best. I don't know who the golden standard is, if there has been one in the last 40 years. But we're probably going back to Reagan, to be honest. But if you're the CEO of the country, you ought to be able to talk about these high-level issues, mm-hmm, these high-importance issues, let me say that, with pretty specificity. I mean, you ought to be able to talk about economic policy, mm-hmm, with some pretty specific detail, right? Tax rates, tax brackets, what tariffs should be on other countries, unemployment rate, right? Interest rates, all of this stuff. You ought to be able to carry on a pretty good conversation and briefing and at least talk about some specifics. But she, I don't know what's going on here, Chris. I mean, either she is just not a smart person, which is very possible. And I'm not trying to, insult her intelligence, but this is all according to her. I mean, we're just playing her clips. Or she's just disinterested,
yeah,
in getting into the nitty-gritty weeds of governing. And it's more about this position of power, and talking specifics and details and actually doing stuff is really not part of the gig.
Yeah. Talking about, power and not really interested in doing the daily ins and outs of the job. There have, for a long time now, been stories about how she just disregards briefings. There has been, yeah, a massive, a very high turnover for people that have worked for her 90% while she's vice president. That tends to show, that's not coincidence. One or two people leaving during a term in office, that's politics as usual.
Yeah.
But when you have a very high turnover rate and you got the advisor basically throwing papers up in the air because she won't open the briefing that you spent all night,
yes,
while your kids and wife were in the bed or whatever,
yeah,
doing, that's very frustrating to people. And it shows an inability to be the leader that people expect you to be. And if she's going to be offended when people question or comment about her inabilities, don't run for president of the United States.
Yeah. I think it's probably the latter, Chris, because you don't get through law school. You don't be a prosecutor, mm-hmm, and the Attorney General of California without some degree of intelligence and ability to understand things. But with this, I mean, I think you're right. I think this is at least partly due to the fact that this whole governing thing bores her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the power thing's fun, right? Being the VP's fun and all the perks and benefits. But actually, governing is kind of boring. And that's why she doesn't listen to briefings. She has a 90%+ staff turnover rate. And she does interviews and she acts completely unprepared. Like, mm-hmm, she did not get a briefing before doing the interview. And you know these interviews are friendly. I mean, mm, she's probably getting fed the questions before.
Oh, yeah.
And she's still fumbling it, mm-hmm, on these interviews. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We'll see you next time. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show. That's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That is why we have partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears the heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies, and that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or 140 helps rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just call #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.